This is Your Life Is Their Toy, Merchants in Medicine by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson, Part 22. Hospital Wars. Competition for medical business is widespread between the quote-unquote closed hospitals themselves, as well as between cliques within the hospitals and between individual members of the hospital staffs. Commercial interests of the profession stew continuously in the corrupt mess of hospital politics, a game of dog-eat-dog. It matters little to the principals that innocent third parties, the patients, lose their lives in the fray. On rare occasions, the continuous guerrilla warfare of the quote-unquote closed hospital brigands that normally is sheltered by the secrecy of the system flares up into bitter and open battle and emerges into the courts. The press then brings it to public attention. Thus, the Fifth Avenue Hospital of New York City, which was built and endowed as a homeopathic hospital, has staged a public battle for the control of the business, attracted by that well-built and attractively located institution. The battle has run through the courts for a decade or more. The homeopaths made the mistake of extending the courtesy of the use of their hospital to allopathic confreres. The latter soon banded together and, with little regard for principle, ethics, or decency, proceeded to oust their hosts from the hospital. When Frank N. Hofstadt, with other contributors to the institution, sued the clique to prevent them from eliminating the homeopaths, Supreme Court Justice Peter Schmuck gave them little comfort. They did not regain control of the hospital and its business until depression threatened its bankruptcy. They were enabled to recapture it by virtual foreclosure, thanks to a windfall bequest of millions from the Wendell estate to the Homeopathic Flower Hospital Medical School. Then another allopathic clique, the Johns Hopkins Medical School crowd, gained control of the business of both the hospital and the medical school through the Rockefeller Foundation. A young henchman of the Johns Hopkins group, Dr. Ferdinand Lee, was made the dean of the Flower Hospital Medical School. He promptly appointed fellow alumni and chums to the heads of the various staffs, and they proceeded to demand the wholesale resignation of the veteran staffs. Similar wars between factions closed the Italian hospital and rocked the Harlem hospital in New York City at about the same time. How a hospital wins ACS quote-unquote approval. How the ACS serves its ringleaders and their allies is illustrated by the affair of the approval of the Beth David Hospital of New York City, the conduct of whose business already has been related. In spite of its widely known business methods, and in spite of the dilapidation and squalor of its buildings, the hospital was approved by the American College of Surgeons. After collecting unknown amounts of money for many years, the Beth David Hospital moved, in 1936, into a large and modern building that was close to the affluent residential district. This meant competition to the established hospitals and surgeons in times that were trying. Within a short time after its removal to the new building, which was as suited for hospital purposes as the old had been unsuited, the Beth David Hospital found itself in difficulties with the American College of Surgeons. It found its name omitted from the list of approved hospitals that is widely published by the ACS local newspapers. Due to the intense adverse publicity that the college can bring to bear on any institution that it desires, and due to the fear of the FACS and those who aspired to that label, the business of the hospital fell off rapidly and it faced another of its series of financial crises. The management of the hospital entered into negotiations to repair the severe commercial damage which the ACS had inflicted on it. The ACS demanded that the hospital's surgeons be ousted and replaced by other FACS. In January 1939, the chief of the surgical staff, who was one of the founders of the hospital, was ousted and his place given to one of the influential henchmen of the American College of Surgeons, Dr. Frederick W. Bancroft. He was given the rank of surgical director, which means boss of the surgical business of the institution, and he brought with him a clique of friends who displaced other staff members. At the very next meeting of the ACS in October 1939, the Beth David Hospital was approved and included in the list published in the New York City newspapers. FACS gang wage fight for Sydenham Hospital. One of the most malodorous hospital scandals that has come out into the open in recent years that illustrates the bitterness of commercial rivalry which the lofty pretensions of the American College of Surgeons mask is the affair of the Sydenham Hospital of New York City. The hospital had been founded by some of the lesser rank medical politicians in conjunction with a group of businessmen. The doctors on the staff paid for their hospital jobs in proportion to their ranks by contributions and by the purchase of dinner and benefit tickets and their sale to friends, and by soliciting donations and bequests. In return, they split among themselves the business lured by the hospital, each man fighting for himself under rules which barred no hold. Though some of the hospital surgeons were FACS and the hospital was approved, they were either sufficiently honest to pay for services rendered them by colleagues, i.e. to split fees, or were compelled to do so by competition. When depression hit the medical profession with full force, the medical politicians and gangs reached out to hijack and grab the business of less powerful rivals and their hospitals. It became the custom of the more powerful medical and hospital groups to seize control of competing institutions, oust the staff, and to turn over the business to their lesser fry. These hospital raids were generally carried out under the banner of the American College of Surgeons on the pretense of, quote, abolishing fee splitting, unquote. And one of the weapons generally used was the threat of withdrawing approval. In line with this policy, the entrenched gang reached out and grabbed control of Sydenham Hospital and its business in 1938. Through the American College of Surgeons, they threatened to withdraw approval of the hospital and to ruin its business unless they were given control of the hospital. They forced over half of the Sydenham's surgeons out on the charge of fee splitting and replaced them with their purse-splitting fellows and their henchmen. Friends of the ousted physicians withdrew their support from the hospital and it soon was run to the verge of bankruptcy. To regain the old supporters of the hospital, Gustavus A. Rogers, one of the original board of the hospital, was made president of the lay board of directors. He undertook to put a stop to the high-handed procedure of the medical gang in packing the hospital with their henchmen and riding roughshod over other physicians who had built up the hospital's business. Illustrative of the, quote, high moral, ethical, and cultural level, unquote, which characterizes all the dealings of the American College of Surgeons and of organized medicine, was the widely publicized brawl at the mass meeting of the hospital's medical staff, reported by the New York World Telegram, January 10, 1940, as follows. Quote, "The case of the physician charged with brutally attacking another member of the hospital staff, breaking two of his ribs. Apparently this was an encounter between Dr. Hellman and Dr. Julius Jarkcho, an attending obstetrician at the hospital. There are various versions of what happened, one being that Dr. Hellman merely shouldered Dr. Jarkcho aside, and another that Dr. Hellman used his fists with vigor." Unquote. Dr. Jarkcho was appointed chairman of the executive committee in Dr. Hellman's place, even though he did not take the count. But the fight was fixed by the American College of Surgeons. Dr. Ralph Culp, the local head of the ACS, is reported to have threatened Dr. Jarkcho with the loss of his FACS if he did not surrender his chairmanship and join the insurgents. Monopolistic control facilitated by hospital surveying. The monopolistic control of hospital facilities by the ACS and its social service allies has been made complete and absolute in New York by the hospital survey. The committee is completely dominated by organized social service and its allies, and in spite of its private character, has official standing. Its decisions determine whether a hospital shall receive public and charitable support, whether it shall be permitted to appeal to the public for funds, or whether it is to shut its doors or to continue to exist. As a consequence of its activities, it can be expected that in the future, the diversion of hospital funds will be channeled into the coffers of certain groups represented well on the committee, and that the monopoly of hospital facilities and their use will be concentrated in the hands of their allies. Judging by past performance, profits rather than public interest will determine the future policies in an ever greater degree. The Rockefellers are represented on the committee by Mrs. Winthrop Aldrich and David McAlpine Pyle. What the ACS costs the public. In still other manners than setting up a monopoly of surgery and upholding needless consultations, does the American College of Surgeons increase the cost of surgical care? It has added to the mounting cost of hospitalization by requiring many wasteful items, such as the keeping of needlessly elaborate records. It requires a multiplicity of quote-unquote staff conferences that tax the time of the profession and yield scant benefit other than the publicity derived from advertisement and from announcement, bearing the names of physicians permitted to present cases that are mailed to the profession. The gravest cost of the American College of Surgeons is the cost in human life. It is related elsewhere how organized medicine used all the machinery at its disposal to prevent the adoption of methods of treating ear and mastoid infections that would eliminate the need for mastoid surgery and to discredit a method of treatment of glaucoma that would wipe out any excuse for the blinding surgical treatment. Operative scores or statistics required of surgeons and hospitals by the ACS contribute heavily to its toll of lives. Though these statistics be innocuous in themselves, the consequences of the efforts of individual surgeons to hold down their scores results in numerous deaths. When there is admitted to an accepted hospital, a grave surgical case involving high operative risk, and requiring the most skilled attention, there is a grand rush of surgeons wishing to uphold their scores to avoid the case unless it be lucrative. Three methods of escape are usual. Either the case is turned over to a member of the intern staff to operate, or is left to die without operation, or is transferred to another hospital. In either case, the life of the patient is jeopardized by denial of the most competent attention available when it is most needed. Transfer is the method of choice in case of patients who appear to be dying after operation. So high is the rate of transfer in some institutions that it is hard to understand why the surgeon's scores there should show any mortality. For the cases which die after transfer are not reckoned on the score of the transferring institution. The callous brutality involved in this traffic of the dying, beggar's description, and cries for a halt. Such are the contributions of the American College of Surgeons and its allies, social service organizations, and hospital organizations to, quote, protection of the health and lives of the public, unquote. Chapter 11. The public versus the, quote, unquote, closed hospital. The rise of hospitals to their present state of physical development has served to improve the care of the ill. Under modern living conditions, such as the small and crowded apartments of our cities, hospitals are essential for the care of the seriously ill. Many cases of illness can be cared for efficiently only in a hospital, for the hospital makes available many of the more complicated and cumbersome devices used in modern medical practice. The very dependence of the public on its hospitals that compels it to accept what is given makes the abuses which have grown up in them just so much more critical and less excusable. Nevertheless, it has become the custom of the public to veer away awesomely and foolishly from the dread topic of hospital abuses. The traditional attitude is, quote, we must have the hospitals in spite of their abuses, since we do not know what to do to remedy the situation, and no one who does know is willing to tell us, we may as well accept it and make the best of it, unquote. This attitude of condoning the abuses merely serves to aggravate the situation. Therefore, I shall not discuss merely the dangers of hospital abuses, but also the remedies. The nature of the work done by hospitals and the high physical state which some of them have attained has served to hide from public gaze some of the serious defects and abuses which have crept into hospital organization and management. But the discriminating patient can quickly discern that much is wrong in hospital and clinic organization. He feels that he is regarded merely as a cog necessary for the operation of the hospital machinery. If he has spirit and demands needed attention, he ranks as a nuisance. He feels that he is recipient of as much individual attention and interest as a bolt emitted from an automatic lathe. He is right in this feeling. In addition to the reasons which have been related, there are others that are rooted in the nature of the hospital rackets that account for it. The hospital has become a business device for mass production, advertising and selling medical and surgical wares. Human values, consequently, may assume curiously distorted proportions in hospitals. Neither patient, physician, nurse, or personnel count for much in the views of the present-day closed hospital administration. Its motto is, folks come and go, but the hospital goes on forever. It is only when hospitals seek to lure funds from the public that there is any pretense of catering to it. The hospital is represented to the public as belonging to it. Contribute to build your hospital was the typical slogan, coined by the clever publicity men, that raised the funds for the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. The patient who has contributed to the hospital, in response to the fraudulent plea that the hospital belongs to him and to the community, may well wonder, on receiving his bill, whether he is not being called upon once again to buy the hospital. The monetary cost of clinic care. The monetary cost to the public of clinic care, in contrast to hospital charges, is quite nominal. In municipal clinics, no charge is made. In the voluntary hospital or pay clinics, the charges may range from pennies to dollars. In some of the medical center pay clinics, charges are sometimes higher than in private practice, but the actual total cost in loss of working time and wages may run very high. An illustration of this cost is case 58 of the 100 neediest cases reported by the New York Times in December 1927. The father of a family of three was required to attend a clinic each morning. As a consequence, he lost his pay for half days, and by exactly that sum, he was pauperized. Public charity was called upon to donate that sum. The man might have had treatment at the hand of a physician privately at a time which would not have interfered with his work and avoided pauperization. Eventually, his clinic medical care made him a public charge. A similar case is that of Leonard P., who suffered from a trivial disorder of the nose, which he was told by the clinic physician required treatment twice a week. He was employed as a cook and earned a fairly good salary, but wished to save the relatively trifling cost of private medical care. To attend the free Bellevue clinic, he was compelled to drop work at midday and take off the balance of the day. As a consequence, he regularly lost his job and was more often unemployed than employed. In the end, he became a public charge. Many needless visits are required of clinic patients for mercenary and other reasons. It is established practice for cities to pay clinics for the care of charity and relief cases, a small sum for each visit. Most voluntary clinics extend little charity, inasmuch as the physician is not usually paid for his services. These sums represent profit to the clinics and hospitals. Consequently, it is demanded of the doctor that he compel the patient to return often, however unnecessary that may be, in order that the sums collected by the institution may be larger. In addition, the larger the number of patients lured into the clinic, the greater will be the business lured into the hospital. Even in municipal clinics, the management and the social workers like to show ever-increasing attendance to justify increasingly larger appropriations. Every town has its army of clinic-bred paupers of the type above described. They do not stop to realize that in seeking cheap or free care, they are losing their jobs and livelihoods. Hospital social service workers do not disillusion them, for they know that clinic attendance butters their bread. They feel that reference of these sick folks to physicians privately would be suicidal. Private practice furnishes no social service jobs, and it is therefore the avowed goal of social service to destroy private medical practice, no matter what the cost to the community. How little charity is extended in the clinics of the voluntary hospitals is indicated by the 1932 annual report of the Manhattan Eye and Ear Hospital, it shows that the hospital made a profit of almost $40,000 on eyeglasses that it furnished its quote-unquote charity clinic patients. High fees in quote-unquote closed hospitals. It is a tragic irony that quote-unquote charitable hospitals often mean financial ruin for the very individuals who have generously contributed to their building and support when they require the services of the hospital. Instances of this can be found in almost any large city. In New York City, for instance, no one factor has contributed more to the impoverishment of Jewish families in normal times than the excessive charges for medical care in the very institutions which they build and support. Most notorious is the case of Mount Sinai Hospital. By adroit publicity and politics, it has built up for itself a reputation for quality and of service and excellence of medical personnel that it has not earned or deserved for many years. When lured thereby to seek the services of the hospital and its staff, the subscribers who seek private care are often excessively charged and cast out or thrown into the wards when their funds are exhausted. It might be said with considerable justice that the most serious disease affecting the Jewish folk of New York is Mount Sinai's itis. The irony of the situation is intensified when such social service organizations as the Federation for the Support of Jewish Philanthropic Societies aid and abet the establishment of rapacious, closed hospital monopolies. Its complexion is not improved by the fact that physicians do not remain on the staffs of institutions that it supports if they fail to contribute to the charity sums of money deemed adequate. Closed hospitals maintain high cost of surgical care. Closed hospital monopolies, fostered by organized medicine, the ACS, and organized social service, raise the cost of medical and surgical care to the public. They are not designed to foster either honesty or fairness, nor do they protect the health and life of the patient, for they compel the family physician to surrender the care of his patient who enters a closed hospital and turn it over to the hospital staff and deny the patient the benefit of truly responsible and personalized care. The surgeon's responsibility to the patient, however, is slight and his dealings sporadic and occasional. A surgeon's reputation is little affected by individual mishaps or deaths. Patients are forced into his hands by the closed hospital monopoly and must accept his services. He is protected by the code of secrecy, to which members of the staffs of closed hospitals are pledged. There is no better way of covering up needless criminal or careless surgery than to perform it in a closed hospital. Quote-unquote closed hospital staff members generally charge patients highly for their monopolistic services. They also do their best to wean them away from outside family physician, who loses caste by being excluded from the hospital and the care of his patient. If and when the patient is returned to the family physician, he is often so stripped of funds that he cannot pay for further services required. The interest of fairness to the patient and his family would be served if they were given an all-inclusive fee for operative services which they might prepare and budget. That fee should include the charges for the very real services rendered by the family physician to both the surgeon and the patient, such as making the initial observations and diagnosis, inducing the patient to seek the surgeon's services, arranging the fee, attending the operation, watching over the aftercare, and following up the results. This should be done openly and with the cognizance of the patient. Such a plan implies the continued care of the patient by his family physician in the hospital. This means elimination of the closed hospital monopolies. There would result protection of health and life of the patient and a material reduction in surgical costs. And this concludes part 22 of Your Life is Their Toy by Dr. Emmanuel Josephson from 1948.